Welcome to Water Insider, a podcast brought to you by DHI. Whether you work with urban or inland water systems, marine or offshore, we get experts to discuss everything water, so you can be the first to learn the latest in water tech and trends.
Hello, good morning, good afternoon, good evening from wherever you are. Welcome and enjoy listening to this podcast about integrated urban water management. My name is Honza Krejčík. I'm an urban water professional. In this podcast, I'm hosting my friends and colleagues from water business, and we are together discussing challenges and topics around integrated urban water management. My guest today is Vladan Babovič, the associate professor of National University of Singapore and one of the leading scientists in the field of hydroinformatics. We started more or less our career like 30 years ago in a very similar institutes. And it's nice to reconnect after a while and talk about the topics of integrated urban water management. Welcome in my podcast, Vladan.
Thank you very much. It's great. We are very good friends. Very old friends, let's say. We are still very young.
Of course we are, and we call it that we are experienced because of the field, and we probably have something to say around it. Speaking about the topic, integrated urban water management, this is the field of science and engineering that we were both working for a while, and it would be nice to hear from you about how the understanding of the topic has developed.
Well, the appreciation of integrated urban water management has only amplified over the past number of years, probably last 5 to 10 years in particular. This is due to the accelerating urbanizations. The cities are getting more compact and more people move to live in cities, are creating a hydrological cycle within these urban areas due to a large percentage of paved areas. So this is one aspect which happens literally in front of our eyes. And all of that is then amplified by this other very strong signal called climate change, where we see a greater intensity of the rainfalls. We see a more frequent and more pronounced drought. These two factors together are not only concerns of engineers. It used to be that 20, 30 years ago, engineers were only concerned about this, but now public in general is aware of that. People simply see that the roads are getting flooded, flash floods. They may not be very long in duration. Sometimes they can be very long in duration. But people just notice these. The signals are very, very strong. Hence the need and recognition for treating water management in an integral fashion becomes much more important.
You want to live in Singapore, which is one of the, let's call it, megacities in a world, and it's state city, you know. And do you think that the people who are living there see how the water managers has changed their approach to manage the water in the cities?
Oh, certainly. Well, Singapore is very small, as you say, city state, around 720 square kilometers. With a population of approximately 5.7 million people. So it is also a very young city. Singapore achieved independence in late 60s. And at that time, this was not a very developed country. So Singapore flooded regularly. So over the years, and many, you know, living generations here, they do remember the floods. They do remember how difficult it was during, particularly during monsoon season, But with development of what was then practice of a very effective drainage system, the flooding reduced. But at that time, Singapore had a population of 2.5-3 million people. So as the density of population increased, the size of population increased, people realized that this is all very fine, but nobody really likes to live in a concrete watertight bunker. Rather, there is a growing interest to work in a nature-inspired, towards nature-inspired solutions. So in Singapore, there is a large program for inland waters called ABC Waters, Active, Beautiful, Clean Waters. And it actually looks at rehabilitating concrete-covered streams into natural-looking rivers in order to increase appreciation of public for the water, hence active and beautiful, but also clean, meaning that bioremediation and removal of pollution from water can be achieved by natural means. So this, it is very interesting to see that maybe 50 years ago, the practices were very much what we would call a classical engineering, very efficient concrete drains, that has shifted maybe over the last 15, 20 years towards more and more nature-inspired solution. People appreciate this change very much because it really adds to the quality of life.
Exactly. And then we are touching now the point where we need to adopt the infrastructure that has been built by, as you call it, by classical approach or traditional engineering approach. And you also mentioned on the example of Singapore that this is pretty young city, but there are many cities, especially in Europe, they are not pretty young. And we need to cope with the infrastructure which has been built sometimes back in 19th century, right? And there are two ways how to do it, right? First, of course, the large rehabilitation programs. This is happening all over the world and in many cities. The second way of how to approach this is try to use the technology to utilize the existing infrastructure for the purpose of today. What would be your uptake in that? Is that anything that you would personally prefer in terms of integrated approach?
The daunting problem of cities being some older, well-developed cities relying on older infrastructure, that problem is here, and perhaps we can address part of it by relying on modern technology. So I see two challenges and I see two opportunities to related to this. The challenge is, of course, to benefit from this pervasive sensing, I would like to call it, right? So it's not only an instruments that are deployed with a purpose of observing a particular phenomenon, rainfall intensity or water level, but actually more and more we can rely on advanced technology to collect the data that were not available maybe 20, 30 years ago. So for, you know, use of computer vision, for example, is a very interesting opportunity where the cameras can be used to observe continuous in real time water levels in rivers and streams. And you can imagine, I think as we speak, you and I probably have on us something like 20 to 30 sensors. Our telephones will have 5 and 6 of them. Our watches, smart watches, will have an additional set of sensors. So all of these data sources become an opportunistic and pervasive sensing environment that we can collect. So it leads to citizen science notion. It leads to obtaining these extremely rich data sets that can hopefully lead to a better management even of somewhat older infrastructure.
That's where we are, both you and I understand where the future should be in terms of using these huge amount of data sets for operational purposes, for day-to-day management of existing infrastructure. This is at least my understanding, how these data should be used, not only for the better planning, but for better utilizing the existing infrastructure. However, these huge amount of data that are going to be collected or being collected needs kind of special technology to understand them and interpret them.
In engineering, even the equations, deterministic equations that we use, even the empirical relationship that we use in engineering, they also are derived or validated against data. They don't come from sky. What is changing today compared to a few decades ago is the volume and the Internet of Things paradigm, where everything is connected to the Internet. Second thing that is different is that an access to an enormous computing power, which is also available on a tip of your fingers, which provides the opportunity to download the data and process this huge volumes of data on extremely powerful computers, hence producing analysis on the fly. In principle, this is not very different than what engineering was maybe 30 years ago. I used to live in Denmark when we developed a bridge between Denmark and Sweden, and that bridge, so this was, I think, 97, 98, these are the years, we used artificial intelligence to forecast the currents between Denmark and Sweden to do operate. So it was seen as a state of the art then. I think it still is quite an advance, and we thought we were dealing with a huge data set. But today, the magnitude of data set has gone tens of thousands times higher. So, this is like, the principles are the same, but these volumes and of data and computing power in combination gives us a complete new quality.
You have mentioned some example of the first use of machine learning, artificial intelligence for forecasting of the behavior of the nature. Since then, the technologies around machine learning has developed extremely fast, at least in the last decade. And would you say that the using of machine learning techniques for the data analysis around these huge data sets is somehow inevitable?
As someone who has been using artificial intelligence and machine learning now for well over 30 years, and still am using it, I will, strangely enough, advocate even stronger than I ever had before that there is a need for a strong coupling of our own understanding with this machine learning. It is actually very easy. The machine learning today is very accessible. You can take a quick internet course, and if you know a little bit of a Python, you can write a script and bang, it suddenly works. But does it work well? Why does it work well? If it does not work, why does it not work well? It's absolutely important to couple the fundamental understanding of phenomena with machine learning. So yes, it is inevitable. Yes, it makes our life easier. But I would argue that responsible and a high quality use of computing in general can only be done if you understand both domain knowledge and machine learning.
I couldn't agree more on that. The combination of deep understanding of engineering problems or scientific problems by understanding the phenomena, and then supported by the power of computers of today is the way forward. And touching that point, where do you think that our educational activities should be focused in the near future? And when I say educational activities, I do not mean only, you know, university courses for students, but maybe also education of the people in the field, I mean, in the private sector right now, the water utility managers, and how we should be educating these people and what should be the topics.
Well, the world has accelerated, and if you went to school maybe 50 years ago, you receive a training, and maybe that training was sufficient to serve one career path for your whole life. Now, this is not the case anymore. And I think the training, if you now talk first about training of young talent, people that are possibly going to, that are still going to universities or just leaving universities, well, the most useful training is to them is to train them in how to continuously learn new things, because this is the fact. The technology evolves very, very quickly, and unless you are moving ahead, if you are staying where you are moving backwards. So you have to, and I now mean everyone, including starting with myself, you have to learn new things every day.
What would be the major driver, even further accelerate for this integrated approach in the cities in the near future? Would it be people's wish to live in a greener cities? Would it be circular economy, let's say the one that you think that will be driving these things forward even faster?
Well, you did mention circular economy and sort of nature-inspired stuff. I think this is obvious.
I mean, is it a society who is driving the things, or is it us as the scientists and engineers who is actually pushing this forward?
I think it's society. It's a societal issue. You know, it's society wants that, and society needs that. We need this. We are part of society, right? So we need that. But this all comes, it boils down to a simple question. And for me, the most significant driver, I would put only in one word, which is uncertainty. You know, we are exposed to greater degrees of uncertainty every day. And the challenge that we have, of course, is how do we plan our infrastructure in a face of such a greater and accelerating uncertainty? So if I'm supposed to design a dam or drainage system or whatever, this is multi-million-dollar project that should live another 30, 40, 50 years. That would be its useful life. And nobody can really tell you what climatological conditions will be in 30, 40, 50 years ahead of time. So what now? I mean, how do I, you know, this is some people call this decision-making under deep uncertainties. Some people call this really an investment problem, because you invest in infrastructure and you don't know under which conditions this infrastructure will operate. So management of uncertainty is a big deal. So let's now look at what traditional engineering approach to this was. You design a structure, and that structure sits there. It cannot adapt. But nature, processes like adaptation, processes like self-repair are normal. You know, if I break my arm, my arm will heal. It will self-repair itself. So in nature, this is normal. But I am yet to see a concrete dam self-repairing itself. Obviously, you can't. So one way of dealing with uncertainty is actually the driver for introducing nature-inspired solution is to couple engineering solutions with nature, so that nature can aid, provide, enhance response. I think this is a combination. This will give you a full economic sense. Why is this such a sensible approach?
This is where I would like to thank you for being a guest in my podcast, Vladan. It was a pleasure to talk to you, and I hope that we will meet soon, not only virtually like today, but also in person. Thank you.
I'm looking forward to seeing you face to face next time.
Thanks for listening to Water Insider. You can find more episodes on our website, dhigroup.com, or anywhere you get your podcasts. And don't forget to follow us.